This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Would You Rather, a memoir of growing up and coming out. This is the author, Katie Haney. Dear reader, for most of my life, I was boy crazy. I can remember every boy I liked all the way back to kindergarten. The only thing that seemed at all off was that as of the age of 26, I had yet to sleep with or date any of them. Until college, I told myself I was shy, a late bloomer. Besides, my parents had made it illegal for me to date before 16, and I was not the sort of teen who breaks the rules. After college, I wasn't as sure what to tell myself anymore. I did my best to explain myself in my first memoir, Never Have I Ever. After it came out, I thought my life would change, and in a way I was right. While change didn't come easily at all or overnight, it did come, eventually, and looking very different than I imagined. Not that I ever felt I had a trustworthy imagination when it came to love. But what makes sense to me now was unimaginable to me even 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I was so sure I knew myself completely. And yet, here I am, unpredicted. If you, too, are a person who has ever found herself Googling something like, is it normal if you've never had a relationship? Or, can someone realize they're queer when they're kind of old? Or, oldest living virgin, if you have ever wondered if it's normal not to feel normal, this one's for you. XO, Katie. Chapter 1, The L Word. The first time it occurred to me that I could be anything less than 100% straight, I was 21. I was also in Spain, halfway into a semester abroad in Madrid, and I was not having a very good time. There were 100 students in my program. Most were American, from the East Coast, though there was also a not insignificant contingent from Cuba and the Dominican Republic. On the flight over, I'd entertained the vague possibility that I might finally find a boyfriend among the students I'd meet and have one of those whirlwind study abroad romances my friends kept having. Then I got there and looked around the auditorium where we first gathered and counted exactly 7 men, total. 2 of whom, I later learned, were gay. Well, at least 2. A third was considered a very likely suspect, but nobody knew for sure. And then, within 3 days of touching down on foreign soil, the cutest of the 5 or 4 straight guys there found the girl who looked most like a sorority president, and she dumped her boyfriend back home, and the 2 of them commenced their whirlwind study abroad romance, whose tumultuous nature would provide a kind of comforting, real-world-esque entertainment for the rest of us. Seeing as the demographics really allowed for only 1 heterosexual, high-drama, study-abroad relationship, I immediately admitted defeat and settled instead on finding lifelong best friends. That mission didn't go much better. The closest I came was a trio of Penn State students who'd arrived in Madrid as a fully formed clique. I could rope them into a night out or, my preference, a daytime historical site visit once in a while. But they were wealthier than me and much bigger partiers than I was. Not hard to be. And kind of bitchy. And I say that with the utmost admiration. I love mean people. It feels so good when a mean person likes you. It's like, I guess I am extremely cool. I basked in that glow for as long as they tolerated my momish friend hurting, which was maybe about a month. My friendlessness, coupled with my inability to afford travel outside the country or eat out very much, meant I had a lot of time to myself. On weekend days, I'd force myself into modest, repetitive adventure. I'd take a bus to Puerto del Sol to buy myself a cream Neapolitan at La Mallorquina, and then window shop and walk through Plaza Mayor. I'd make yet another trip to the Prado and visit my favorite paintings and write depressing journal entries. I have never been very good at open-ended exploring, and back then I was even worse. If I must do it, I need at least 1 fixed destination, usually involving food, and once there, I can wander within a small, neat circumference of that spot. Before going anywhere alone, I triple-check my routes, and usually I overestimate how long it will take me to get there. It isn't quite getting lost that I fear so much as it is the associated embarrassment. Looking lost, or looking somehow out of place. Looking alone. My guilt wouldn't allow me to wallow in my host's apartment all day every weekend, but it did not mind if I did so most weeknights after school. In the afternoons, at the end of my half-hour, humid, and mostly uphill walk home from the university, I would stop at the shop across the street to buy a Diet Coke and a little bag full of gummy candy, and then I'd head upstairs for the night. There I'd eat the late lunch my generous, if curmudgeonly, senora made daily for my roommate and me, though because my roommate had a life, I often ate for us both. And then, with 3 or 4 hours left before I could reasonably go to bed, I would watch TV. There was no Netflix streaming at that time, so I illegally and painstakingly downloaded everything I watched, one episode at a time. There was also no Wi-Fi, so in order to do this, I had to plug my laptop into the modem by an Ethernet cord I stretched across the tiny living room to the dining room table, where I sat to watch shows until my señora came home. She'd walk in around 6 each evening and, finding me sitting there, say, "Ya estás. You're still here." Sometimes, I'd wait a while before my retreat and we'd watch TV separately, together. Me at the table, watching on my laptop with headphones on, eating gummies. Her on the couch, watching talk shows on her 32-inch screen, eating a bowl of potato chips. Sometimes I'd head right for my room, my loneliness making that kind of extended, quiet indifference to each other feel intolerable. If I opened each episode of a show in its own tab and it finished downloading all the way before I disconnected, I could watch it atop the scratchy IKEA comforter in my room. If it didn't finish, or an episode froze up 5 minutes in, which happened a lot, I was devastated. Then I'd have to read, or, worse, write more depressing journal entries. First, I worked my way through The Office, starting again from the beginning. Then I rewatched the better seasons of Sex and the City, 2 through 4. Then I felt like watching something I hadn't already seen. Ideally, something with more than 4 seasons, so I knew it might last me a significant portion of my remaining time in Madrid. Nothing soothes me like a long-term goal. And with no social life of my own to speak of, I knew I wanted something with lots of relationships and friendships and drama. Beyond these criteria, I don't remember exactly how it was that I arrived at the L word. All I know is that as soon as I started the pilot, I was hooked. That's not to say the show was very good, which it often wasn't. The music, to say nothing of the theme song, was melodramatic, as was the plot. The characters' behavior was frequently reprehensible, and their clothing, insane. But almost all of those reprehensible characters were women, and the less reprehensible ones, for nobody on that show is truly innocent, were too. My screen was full of women. Their omnipresence was striking. I couldn't believe that a show like this had ever aired, for multiple seasons. And yes, it was premium cable, and yes, everyone on it was skinny and beautiful, and almost everyone was femme and white, and yes, it was so, so far from perfect. But it was also so, so different from everything I was used to. I was, and am, used to watching shows and movies dominated by men, and secondarily, the women they sleep with. It's been more than 10 years since the first episode of The L Word aired, and, aside from the rare exception, like Orange is the New Black, that hasn't really changed. Women are one another's friends, sometimes, but mostly they are men's girlfriends and wives. In The L Word, every role was played by a woman. Temptress cafe owner, millionaire philanthropist, sexy carpenter, failing novelist, famous athlete, closeted cougar wife, sex worker cum hairstylist, DJ. This world, in its forceful femaleness, was something that greatly appealed to me. I did not feel a part of it, but I found myself longing to be. Mostly, I thought, this was because I missed my own world of girls, carrying on our life together without me, back at school in Illinois. But it kind of seemed like there was something else going on, too. That thing was Shane. If you haven't seen the show, do yourself a favor and Google image search Shane McCutcheon right now. I mean, look at her. Shane, played by Kate Menig, is the L-Word's resident heartbreaker, an impossibly skinny, impossibly gorgeous jerk with disheveled hair the likes of which would suggest grave instability on anyone else's head. She's a womanizer and a cheater and possibly a moron, and yet she is so, so hot. There is her mouth, pouty lips always hanging open, the gravelly low voice that comes out of it. There are her fingers, bony and covered in silver jewelry. The first thing I distinctly remember her wearing was some sort of low-cut, lace-up, leather halter crop top with leather pants slung so low you could see her pelvic bones. I was sort of like, what the fuck is that outfit? But I was also intrigued. Leather halter top incident aside, Shane was, by far, the most boyish lesbian of the bunch. I had never seen anyone like her. Back then, before I knew any better, I thought that the rest of the characters on the show could just as easily have passed for straight. But I didn't see how anybody could look at Shane, and for even a second, think she'd be interested in sleeping with men. She was usually dressed in muscle tees that highlighted her flat chest and lean, muscular arms, or else t-shirts under oversized blazers. She wore boots or sneakers, but never heels or flats. Early on, there were also a lot of bad belts and arm cuffs, but you have to forgive her for that, because it was the early aughts, and everyone was accessorizing like there was no tomorrow. Shane was tall, too, always lifting girls' faces by the chin so she could kiss them. Often she had not yet spoken more than two words to these girls, but it didn't matter how implausible it was, because everyone was happy. Shane, the girl she was kissing, and me, watching, invested enough in this character's sexcapades that I soon started to wonder if it meant something. It soon became imperative for me to know if the actress who played Shane was gay in real life, too. It was in the process of this online investigation, Googling as many variations on the search terms Kate Manning gay and Kate Manning girlfriend and Kate Manning sexuality as I could think up, that I learned exactly how cliched my fascination was. I found web forums dedicated to this topic alone, and I clicked through dozens of pages, inhaling every bit of trivia or baseless speculation I came across. There were a number of Yahoo Answer posts written by straight girls wondering if their attraction to Shane meant they weren't so straight after all. Did watching the L Word make me bi? There were t-shirts for sale that read, "I'd go gay for Shane" across the chest. At first, it was comforting to know I was far from the only one with a Shane fixation. The more I read, the easier it was to decide that Kate Manning was simply one of those people whom everybody, no matter their orientation, is attracted to. Knowing that there were a bunch of other self-identified straight girls who were crushing on the same actress as I was didn't strengthen my feelings. If anything, it diminished them. Having a crush on this woman in particular didn't mean much about my sexuality, the same way that finding The Office funny doesn't mean much about your sense of humor. It just meant I was a human being with an extremely popular opinion. Still, I wrote a Facebook message to my best friend Riley back home, under the auspices of catching her up on what I'd been doing, nothing, and how I'd been feeling, bad, sad. And, by the way, there's this random TV show I'm newly obsessed with. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I know it included something along the lines of, "I think watching this show is making me turn into a lesbian." And then I attached a picture of Shane. I love to present my concerns and insecurities as half-jokey hyperbole so that nobody can tell I'm actually very serious and terrified. It's like I believe that if I make a joke about it, it can't come true. It's the same thing I do when I'm at the doctor and I attempt to ingratiate myself with the nurse by joking about the fact that I think I have a brain tumor because I get headaches a lot. Riley knows this about me, so, understandably, she took this confession with a pretty massive grain of salt. In her reply, she did all the right things. She asked me questions and told me that no matter who I was attracted to, I was fine and normal, and told me she loved me. She also wrote that she agreed. Shane was extremely hot, and even she would probably have sex with her, or at least make out with her for a little bit. So maybe that was all it was. In her message, Riley asked if I thought I was attracted to other women, and I wrote back that I didn't know. She asked if I was still attracted to men, and I wrote that I was. But after I sent it, I second-guessed myself. As a sort of unscientific experiment with myself, I walked around Madrid looking only at the women and none of the men. I stared at the prettiest ones, trying to deduce whether I looked because I was admiring someone pretty or because I was attracted. I felt that in the course of watching the show, I had lost the ability to tell the difference. Maybe I had been so thoroughly exposed to women by a single female-dominated TV show as the only possible object of desire that I had suddenly lost the ability to feel otherwise, as if my previous heterosexuality had been, effectively, brainwashed out of me. Like, basically what evangelical Christians argue can happen to youths exposed to LGBTQ culture had actually happened to me. I knew this was ridiculous, and yet I could not let it go. With no one to talk to and nothing much I could bring myself to do, thinking was all that was left. In the best of times, I am prone to overanalysis, but when I am lonely, there is no limit to how far inward I can go. On the bus, in class, in my bed, waking up before my alarm went off, I tried to work through my sexuality like a mathematical theorem. If A equals zero boyfriends thus far, and B equals the number of times you rewound that Shane and Carmen sex scene, C equals maybe kinda gay. But then, if A equals the dozens of real-life crushes on boys you've had, and B equals the zero of real-life crushes on girls you've had, C equals straight, probably. But then. One night, when I was about halfway into season 4 of The L Word, the episode froze. I tried downloading it from another site, but that one froze too. So did the third. By then, I was far enough into my trip that the end was in sight, and I think that's why it wasn't so hard to let go. That, and the fact that I'd worn myself out. The L Word wasn't making me gay, but it had inspired an existential crisis I was no longer interested in experiencing. So, instead, I went about making the most of my remaining time in Spain, doing all the things I maybe should have been doing all along, but could only rarely bring myself to do. I went to see Guernica and cried. I went to the southern coast with my cool, mean pseudo-friends for a long weekend. I ate all the things that had comforted me over those 4 months, knowing that eventually I'd miss them, that eventually I'd forget just how sad I'd been walking through the city alone to buy them. And then, finally, I went home. That fall, at the beginning of my senior year in college, I had crushes on two boys at once. For me and my overly dedicated brain, that was a rare feat. One was a freshman, LOL, and the other was a junior, and together they took up enough of my brain space to push aside whatever remaining Shane obsession I had. At least until my birthday, when Riley bought me the 5th season of The L Word on DVD, and I watched it in 2 days, and I was as glued to Shane's face as ever. I didn't know what, if anything, it meant, but for the moment, I didn't want to care. When I moved home after graduation, I hid the DVDs behind a row of books on my shelf instead of putting them up front with my others. It wasn't that I thought owning them was wrong, necessarily, or even that owning them meant something definite about me. It was that they didn't fit in. It was that I worried their presence might require an explanation, and I did not have one. Girl number one I probably liked, now that I'm thinking about it. Eliza, 2nd through 4th grade. In the Catholic K-8 school I attended through the 4th grade, the way a girl got popular was to be more like the boys. Maybe that changed after I left, sometime after the girls turned 13 and the uniform switched from unisex leggings to tartan skirts, but as children, we placed a premium on tomboyishness. No jewelry, apart from a crucifix. No nail polish, no dolls. At recess, we played kickball, and Eliza was always the first girl chosen. She had white blonde hair and an ongoing flirtation with the most popular boy in our class, mostly involving sports-based one-upmanship. Her circle was made up of the girls lucky enough to be both pretty and athletic. Occasionally, they did the charitable thing and loosened their standards. I remember sitting at their cafeteria table next to my best friend, Claire, being given our entrance exam. Eliza would say a city or a state, and we had to name as many sports teams that went with it as we could. You were allowed 2 strikes, and then you were out. Claire failed. Thanks to my father, I narrowly passed. My reward, as I recall it, was to be invited to all of their birthday parties. For a brief period, I enjoyed the privileges of being one of Eliza's favorites, and so she invited me over after school. We played Gangsta's Paradise by Coolio on her parents' fancy stereo and sang along. The next year, when she started going out with the popular boy, I was, unspecifiably, pissed. Chapter 2. Girl Crush. The first girl I ever consciously had a crush on sat across the lecture hall from me in a class that might as well have been called Depressing Facts About Our Political System 101. I was in my 2nd year of graduate school at the University of Minnesota, most of which was an extremely expensive blur. I was 25. I don't recall her name, although I know at some point I figured it out by process of elimination, cross-referencing the class list against Facebook. It feels like it might have been Taylor. If not, she would have made a good one. Taylor came to school that fall with golden skin and a haircut that, to me, suggested there was at least a possibility she'd brought a picture of Tegan and Sarah to the salon. Long, swooping bang in front, chopped short everywhere else. Dark blonde, almost the exact color of her skin. I know it seems crazy, but she was the first person I'd really looked at and thought, huh, that girl might be gay. What I knew for sure was that she dressed amazingly. Not that the bar was particularly high in a Midwestern public policy graduate program, but she vaulted leaps and bounds above it. Some days she dressed tomboyishly, ripped jean shorts and chucks with an oversized button-down shirt, and other days she dressed more femme, a sundress and espadrille wedges, a bandana tied Rosie the Riveter style around her head. Our class met just once a week, and Taylor seemed to miss at least a third of our sessions. If we got more than 5 minutes into class and she hadn't shown up, I'd feel let down. Then the weather got colder and she started showing up in a leather jacket, and I became more forgiving. Obviously, she had a lot of cool things going on in her life. My crush on Taylor was different from crushes I had on boys. That much I knew. It felt even more theoretical, even less worth doing something about. I did not picture us holding hands or kissing or even really talking. I did not envision a future in which we were girlfriends. I did not obsess over her in the same way or enter into the familiar cycle of nervous excitement, hope, frustration, hope, anguish, disappointment. I just noticed her and kept noticing her and wondered every time I saw her if she was gay. I liked looking at her. I wondered if it was only that I wanted to look like her, and then I thought, no, I'm pretty sure that's not it. But still, somehow, it didn't feel real. I hoped that we would be put in the same discussion group at some point, but when we weren't, I was never crushed. I told Riley about her, but not in very much detail. It felt more like an inside joke than anything serious, like a girl crush, devoid of any real sexuality. I presented it winkingly, like, isn't this funny how I'm taken with this girl? And so Riley did not take it seriously either. But I stared at Taylor far too much to play it off entirely as a joke to myself. Anyway, it turned out she had a boyfriend. And from the beginning of the semester to the end of the year, when I saw her on campus holding his hand, she slowly grew out that perfect haircut. So I forgot about her. But then I got a crush on another short-haired girl I saw around school. We had no classes together, so I saw her almost never. She was short, with short, sandy brown hair she tousled in the front and often tucked under a yellow beanie. She wore men's clothing, another revelation, another girl unlike any I'd ever seen in real life. For a long time I didn't know her name, so I, jokingly, called her that girl I'm in love with. Then Riley had a class with her and learned her name was Kristen. When I talked about Kristen with Riley, we had much the same conversation as when earlier moments of sexual confusion, over Shane on the L word, or all the sensual lip biting in Tegan and Sarah's Call It Off video, had left me stressed and obsessive. Riley, maybe you're just not 100% straight. Most people probably aren't. Me, yeah. Riley, I mean, I think plenty of girls are hot. Me, I know. Riley, would you want to date her? If she were single, I mean. Me. I don't know. I can't picture it. Of course, then, I couldn't really picture dating anyone. Riley. Well, try not to worry about it. Just see who you like. Riley always made it abundantly clear that she would love me no matter who I was attracted to, and I knew that was the truth. But I also think there was a pattern to these discussions that made me come off like the girl who cried gay. Or, at least, that's how I felt each time I talked to one of my straight friends about it. Then I met Sheila. It was in another class I can, surprise, hardly remember, though I know the subject was feminist policy. I got there early the first day, and about 10 minutes later, Sheila came in and sat down next to me. I remember immediately wanting to know her. Half her head was shaved, and the rest of her thick, curly black hair was pulled into a high ponytail. She had tattoos up and down both arms and unshaved armpits. She wore red lipstick and a very short skirt. She said hi, I said hi back, and then we became friends in the typical shared class trajectory. Sitting by each other turned into walking to class together, turned into studying together, turned into saying hi at student happy hours. It was on one of those early walks to or from class, over a bridge with an insulated pathway to protect students from Minnesota winters, that Sheila told me she was queer. Perhaps I should not have been scandalized or surprised, but I was. While she was certainly not the first queer woman I had known, she became, in that moment, the first woman I knew for certain to be queer. That semester, Sheila was reeling from a fairly recent breakup with a long-term girlfriend, and once I knew that, we entered my favorite phase of a new friendship. The one in which each person details their relationship history from start to finish, beginning with the most recent and working backward. My half of the conversation was always much shorter, which is just as well, because I have always preferred to listen. We were both single and frustrated. Sheila, because, in her words, she needed to get laid. And I, because, in my words, I was confused. In a roundabout sort of way, I intimated my identity crisis to Sheila, hemming and hawing about how I wondered if it was possible, maybe, that I was not as straight as I'd always thought. When she asked the question, "Well, how do you identify?" I realized I didn't know how to answer. Every real life and almost every celebrity crush I'd had before that year had been heterosexual, and yet the word straight, when applied to myself, felt increasingly uncomfortable, like a shirt I'd grown out of but couldn't bring myself to discard. I suspected that I experienced more attraction to women than the average straight girl, but I wasn't sure that it was enough to earn any other label. As soon as I started talking about sexuality to Sheila, I couldn't stop. It was different, easier and heavier all at once than talking to Riley about it. I confessed to her that I'd recently changed my OkCupid orientation to bisexual for a single night. I was on my third or fourth stint on the site at the time, and late one night, huddled over my laptop in my dark bedroom, I simply changed myself from a straight woman to a bisexual one, with a single click. I looked through a few profiles, more trying to imagine myself as someone who was genuinely appraising these women than actually feeling like I was that person. I felt clammy and self-conscious, and when I woke up the next morning, I switched myself back to straight again. But from then on, Sheila considered me a queer person, and I let her. Sometimes we'd talk about guys. She started dating one toward the end of the year, and that always felt natural. Sometimes we'd talk about girls, and that did not. One spring afternoon near graduation, we sat on a sunshiny bar patio with Riley. We talked about finals and graduation, and then about two of Sheila's female friends who were going to meet up with us. "Are they cute?" I asked. I was on my second margarita. Immediately, I was embarrassed. I felt like I was playing a character, a young metropolitan woman at ease with her fluid, freewheeling sexuality. It seemed transparently disingenuous, especially with Riley there. Riley, who had comforted me through so many failed heterosexual crushes. I felt like a fraud. Surely nobody bought me as an actual queer person. Not even I did. "They're cute," Sheila said, nodding, and I let the subject drop. It was one thing to talk about sexuality as a theoretical possibility. But, as usual for me, the moment other people became potentially involved, I wanted to run away from both them and myself. I wanted to sink into the earth. Riley and I went home before the cute friends even showed up. The day we graduated was hot and underwhelming. I wore the same dress I'd worn to my college graduation 3 years earlier. As it always does on days when I expect a lot from it, my hair underperformed. I wore flat sandals so that when I walked across the stage to accept a diploma I was already starting to regret signing up for, I wouldn't trip. After the ceremony, we took family and friend photos on the lawn outside. I posed with Riley. I posed with Sheila, too. And then, 10 hours later, we made out. What happened was, we drank too much. What happened was, the graduating class went out to celebrate that night at a bar. I changed from my floral anthropology dress into an electric blue one that static clung to my legs and made it difficult to walk at the speed to which I am accustomed. I don't remember much of being out that evening, but I do remember walking home through campus, me and Riley and Sheila and this guy Devin, deciding to take a shortcut through several interconnecting buildings that would kick us out on the street opposite ours. We walked past the business building, through economics, and into political science, opening the door to the descending stairwell outside the library. Once we were on the stairs, someone, and knowing her, I'm nearly positive it was Riley, said, "I always wanted to make out with someone in this stairwell." I was first to the bottom of the stairs, turning to say that I'd once walked through a couple's fight in that stairwell, when Sheila pushed me against the wall and kissed me. Riley hollered and Devin laughed nervously. Because Sheila really went for it, and because I was drunk, and because I was yet again graduating from another era of my life with the sense that I didn't have all that much to show for it, apart from 5 digits worth of debt, I went for it too. "Geez," said Devin. "But I still didn't get to," said Riley. I pulled away, laughing, and we pushed open the door, emerging outside the conference room where Riley and I had once been scolded for taking cookies off our refreshment table meant for the people meeting inside. "It pays to be queer," sang Sheila. She took my hand in hers and swung it back and forth. Kissing her had felt more or less like the other few times I'd drunkenly and sexlessly kissed my female friends at frat parties in college, the way straight girls sometimes do when you're drinking at a party and you know boys are watching and it feels important to know you are capable of turning them on. For show. Kissing Sheila was a performance. I squeezed her hand anyway, and we left the building to walk toward home. I went to bed just sober enough to wonder how I'd feel the next morning. Sure that I would feel different, grown up, changed, clearer, for having kissed an actual queer person. To my disappointment, I didn't. I'd found no easy solution to the problem of me. All I had was another name on the fairly short list of people I'd kissed without feeling what I knew I was supposed to when it counted. Chapter 3. Flyover Country. I always liked living in Minnesota, but it did not occur to me to make loving it part of my personality until I lived somewhere else. I'd lived there my whole life, so when I was first looking around for colleges I might go to, I looked almost exclusively out of state. I knew enough about myself to know that if I was ever going to get out of the nest, I was going to have to hurl myself out. I cried on every first day of school I had until I was maybe 13. I had never been to a sleepaway camp and did not go to anything resembling a real high school party until I was a senior. In so many words, I was a real weenie. So wherever I went to college needed to be far enough away from home that I could not fall back on it. Then again, I didn't want to be so far away that I could not drive there within a day. I fell in love with a small university in central Illinois, approximately an 8-hour drive from my parents' house. Throughout college, my plan always was to return to Minnesota, and I spent much of that time trying to brainwash my new Illinois friends into thinking they might want to live there too. It was cheaper than Chicago, I reasoned, and much less bro-y, and everyone was so nice and so tall. 6 months after we graduated, living with our parents and working menial jobs we hated, Riley and I decided we missed being in school and figured we should just go back. We both wanted to study public policy, so I immediately began the hard sell on the graduate program at the University of Minnesota. We applied, we got in, and she moved from the Chicago suburb where she was living with her parents. I did it, I thought. Thus began what I expected to be the rest of our lives in Minnesota. Riley and I lived in Minneapolis together for 3 years. For the first, we lived in a fake fancy apartment built for students, most of them undergrads, paying almost twice as much as we should have because it had a gym we'd use once and because it was across the street from where most of our classes were held. When that lease was up, we made the move to a building farther from school, but half as expensive. It took us maybe 20 minutes to walk to class every day, but most Minnesotans aren't in the habit of commuting by foot, especially in the winter. But I found I enjoyed the forced mind wandering these walks provided, and I soon started coming up with little story ideas on the way to and from school. There were 7 or 8 blogs and websites I read religiously around this time, and at some point it occurred to me that maybe I could write for one of them. That summer, during break, I'd submitted a story I'd written to my favorite website at the time, The Hairpin. The site mostly featured writing from young women who hadn't been published before, one of whom would later become my first roommate in New York, and this made it seem possible that I could be one of them. I hadn't intended to make a habit of writing, really, but when the piece was published and I saw my name in print and read all the nice comments, I got addicted. I started writing more for other sites too, and then a literary agent emailed me, and suddenly I was working on a book. As a result, I spent most of my second year of grad school mentally checked out. I didn't want to network or go to talks or do any of the other things my classmates were doing to try to get policy jobs. I wanted to write. I could have quit the program and saved myself a year of debt, but I knew I shouldn't count on writing as a career. Finishing school was the practical thing to do, so I did it. After we graduated, Riley and I moved into an almost comically charming apartment complex in South Minneapolis. Old brick buildings covered in ivy, surrounding a courtyard lined by hedges and gardens. There was no central air and the heating was furnace only, unusual in Minnesota, and no dishwasher, but otherwise it was perfect. We intended to stay there until one of us met a man worth moving in with, and we both had every reason to believe that it would be Riley. She didn't have a boyfriend at the time, but it was pretty much the first time in our friendship that she hadn't. I, on the other hand, had never had one at all. I bought the heaviest desk I could buy, a sturdy wood thing almost 6 feet long and over 2 feet deep, deposited in my room by the two biggest men I'd ever seen in my life. It was a very, very heavy desk. It wasn't going anywhere, so neither was I. This was where I would work on my book, which went out to publishers shortly after I graduated. I maintained a half-hearted search for policy jobs while waiting to see if my book would sell, hoping somehow it would work out so I didn't have to get one. It worked out. My agent called me one morning to tell me that someone, two someones even, wanted to buy my book. I was more relieved than excited, though I was that too. I didn't have to get a government job. I'd been right to spend a full school year working on a book that could have gone nowhere. I could make a living from writing. For now, anyway. Riley soon got a job that let her work from home too, and together we expressed a lot of good intentions about how we would structure our days. We would be at our desks from 8 to 4 or 9 to 5, breaking for a lunch we'd prepare together to save money on groceries. When we were done, we'd work out, and then we would hang out with other friends at their apartment or a bar. I'd spent most of my young life hoping I'd end up in a situation like this one, living with my best friend, both of us single, starting our actual adult lives together. I'd always thought I wanted my world to be smaller, my friends close, my job close, my social life at home. Any and all boyfriends existed somewhere nebulous outside this perfect little universe, if at all. It occurs to me now that what I wanted was a partner. And for a while, living with Riley was almost like having one. We did grocery shop together and eat lunch together and often worked together across the dining room table. Working at home turned out to be a challenge, however, since we suffered from similarly powerful mixtures of Catholic and Midwestern and strict parent guilt, and both felt ashamed and unproductive if we weren't constantly working. So we tried to help each other feel okay about working until 2 or 3 instead of 5 or 6. On weekends, we took day trips around the state and occasionally hung out at parties at our friend Colleen's dental school fraternity for as long as we could stay awake. We settled into the kind of rituals other domestic partners share. A pizza night, Thursdays, Frozen Jacks, a distribution of chores, a shared TV show to watch 2 episodes of together before bed. For a little while, I really, truly loved it. This is the kind of environment I'm built to thrive in. A rut. Or so I thought. Because after a while, even I got bored, and boredom makes me depressed. First, I stopped getting dressed in the mornings, because what was the point? The only human I saw most days was Riley, and she wasn't getting dressed anymore either. Then I stopped working at my desk, because as beautiful as it was not as comfortable as my bed. Around 3 or 4 in the afternoons, I would change into workout clothes. But instead of going for a run or a walk outside, I got my exercise in the form of 30-minute Jillian Michaels DVDs in the living room. Then I would shower and put my pajamas right back on again to make dinner, which I ate in front of the TV. The next day, I would do the same. This is how I got through 13 seasons of Law & Order SVU in less than a year. I didn't allow myself to recognize that I was unhappy at first. It didn't make sense. I had wanted to live in Minnesota after college, and that's exactly what I was doing. I had wanted to live with Riley, and here we were. I wasn't seeing much of anybody else, but I couldn't think of many other people I cared to see. Even after I bought my own car, I couldn't really think of anywhere to go. The person I liked hanging out with most was right here. Why go anywhere else? Mixed in among those indistinguishable days, there were still some of the most comforting and most challenging evenings of my life, just talking to Riley. I'm sure other friends have influenced my character and my decision-making, but none so profoundly as her. We have been friends since we were 18. I haven't been an adult without her. Neither of us is particularly religious, but we are spiritual insofar as it serves the story of us. We are soulmates, deliberately placed by some mysterious force on opposite sides of the same dormitory floor. And now, here we were, in the living room, in our perfect apartment, each of us curled up on the couches we'd wordlessly claimed as our own. It never mattered how much we talked about something before. There was always a few hours worth more to be said. When we agreed about something, which was usually the case, I felt stronger, less alone. When we disagreed, which happened often earlier in our friendship and less as time went on, I felt angry, as determined I was right as she was. Then whatever it was would come up again, and I'd still disagree, but a little less stringently than before. Before I knew it, I had grown. When friends of ours joked that it was as if Riley and I, spending our nights together in front of the TV, were married, they were not wrong, and they did not mean it in a nice way. They meant that we were 30 years in and sexless married. They meant we were codependent homebodies who ate dinner at 5 p.m. married. At first it was funny, an exaggerated joke, but over time it seemed truer and truer, and it started to bother us both. We really weren't going out very much. We weren't dating anyone. We were 26 years old. We were not ready to have the lives of 70-year-old retirees yet. 10 months or so into our life in that beautiful apartment, I looked around at the job I could do from my bed, the roommate who was also my best friend, and I realized that I could very easily keep living like this, here, with her, for the rest of my life. There was nothing in the foreseeable future that was going to change any part of it. For the first time in my life, I had the stasis I'd always wanted, and that scared the shit out of me. So when I sold my first book, and my agent and new editor suggested I think about making a trip to New York to meet them in person, it seemed like a sign. I had never given New York much thought before then, and didn't particularly expect to like it. But I needed to do something different, even for just a few days. I asked Riley if she'd like to come with me, and she said sure. Then I asked if it was okay if we took the train. She paused. From here? Let me explain. I was perfectly fine with flying until I was 19. That spring, I flew to China for a 3-week trip with a college class, and on the way over, I stood by a window at the back of the plane and gaped at the endless, brilliantly white ice stretching out below us as we crossed over the North Pole. The way back was different. Soon after takeoff, the plane began to shake. Turbulence does not begin to describe it. This felt as if a pair of giant hands was slapping us back and forth between them. And then, occasionally, we'd plummet. Or so it felt. After one particularly bad jolt, people began to pray and to cry. The voice of the flight attendant came over the speaker, shouting, "Everyone, stay in your seats!" She sounded afraid, and if she was afraid, I figured that couldn't be good. I clasped my friend Amy's hand tightly, and as we dipped again, my life flashed before my eyes. I remember thinking, I can't believe that actually happens. Eventually, after what felt like at least an hour, the turbulence stopped. I have no idea how much time actually passed. I only know it was enough to traumatize me. The rest of the flight was perfectly, eerily smooth. I overheard a woman sitting in the row behind mine tell her neighbor that she'd been praying with a beaded bracelet a monk gave her during her visit to the Shaolin Monastery. The implication, I think, was that we owed her our lives. From then on, if I could get somewhere without a plane, I would. And if a friend proposed taking a trip to somewhere accessible only by plane, I would invent a reason I couldn't go. I pretended it was a matter of preference. I have always liked traveling by train or car. When I was a kid, my family vacations were mostly road trips. We'd drive 2 or 3 days from Minnesota to Glacier National Park, Montana, or Washington, D.C., or Tucson, Arizona, staying there a few days and then driving back. I remembered these trips as opportunities to eat lots of fast food and buy those little velvet pouches of pink and green rocks, but also to stare out the window and do absolutely nothing. And because I have never really been able to justify doing nothing when I am not in transit, I have always appreciated having relaxation forced upon me. True, the longest time I'd traveled nonstop previously was 14 hours. And true, the train ride from Minneapolis to New York via Chicago would be 36. But that would include sleeping. Or so I thought, until we were actually on the train. The lights went out, and I reclined my seat as far back as it would go, pulled up the little leather seat extender, and stretched out. My legs dangled uncomfortably a good 8 inches off the end. Riley glared at me from the seat next to mine. I was okay up until hour 30. It was the last 6 that really did me in. You get to a point where you think you're close to the city because you can see it, but what you do not realize is that it will take you 2 hours to creep along that final stretch, your legs starting to hurt from the nonstop, restless bouncing. But somehow we got there. And I hated it, just like I thought I would. We caught a cab to the Chelsea studio apartment we were renting for our 4-day stay along with our friend Joyce, who'd come up from med school in Philadelphia. My first thought upon walking through the front door was that the place had, somehow, seemed a lot bigger in the photos. We'd chosen it because it was centrally located and close to the BuzzFeed offices, where I had a part-time writing contract and planned to visit once or twice while I was there. We also chose it, I think, because Chelsea is one of the New York neighborhoods that people who don't live in New York and have never been can readily name. It seemed glamorous or something. But being in that apartment, and later, walking around to find dinner, I felt underwhelmed. As someone who lives in any other part of the country, you see New York depicted so often and so prettily that it's hard not to get there, take one look around you, and think, this is it? Then, too, everyone living in New York seemed obsessed with the fact that they lived in New York, and I found their smugness incredibly obnoxious. Obnoxious despite the fact that the only real difference between New York City pride and Minnesota pride is that the former has 3 million more people and all of pop culture backing it up. Like many Midwesterners who do not hear their home states referenced much outside the context of their major league sports teams, I was born on the defense and had an outsized territoriality because of it. How dare anyone call my home state flyover country? How could so many people possibly think that they lived in the best place in the world when, in fact, I lived in the best place in the world? When I first went to New York, it was partly with the goal to prove myself right. The city wasn't for me and never would be. I already lived where I was meant to be and where I was sure I'd always want to stay, Minnesota. And when I got home, I felt safe. But a year later, I went back to New York. Once again, I took the train all the way out, but this time I did so knowing that I could not and would not take the train back home. I was going out to take an intensive course of exposure therapy for my fear of flying at Hofstra University and write about it for BuzzFeed. And at the end of this course, I would fly home. This time I knew enough to stay on the Lower East Side instead of Chelsea. But between the noise from the street outside and the fear of what awaited me at the end of the week, I hardly slept. Each morning that week, I took the subway to Penn Station and got on the Long Island Railroad out to the Hofstra campus, where two psychology grad students tried to scare me out of my fear of flying. The theory being that the more you are exposed to the stimulus that scares you, the less power it will have over you. The thing you're most afraid of is not actually the thing itself, but the way you imagine it. Avoiding your fear only makes it loom larger, so you must confront it as much as possible. Fair enough, but what a terrible way to spend a week. I spent most of the first 2 days strapped into a beat-up old airplane chair that shook when the virtual reality program strapped to my head took my make-believe flights through a thunderstorm. When I was not in the headset, I was instructed to close my eyes and describe imaginary plane crashes in great detail. By the end of each session, I felt drained and dull, and would find myself walking through Penn Station with little memory of how I'd gotten there. Still, I went out every evening after I got back to the city, reanimated by the open-endedness of every warm May night. It helped that I had a crush, not just on the one person in particular, more on that later, but also on everyone I met. Something had shifted between my first trip to New York and my second. My career was there. My people, my creative, brilliant, sardonic, internet-obsessed people were there. I did not know many of them very well yet, but there was so much possibility. Little by little, my life had moved to New York without me. At the end of the week, I got on a plane for the first time in 4 years and flew back to Minneapolis. My student therapists took me to the airport, and before I went through security, I told them that if, after all this, my plane crashed, I would haunt them for the rest of their lives. By then, they knew me well enough to know that making jokes was how I coped with my terror. I was nervous, but less nervous than I expected to be. My sense of responsibility finally outstripped my fear. The therapists told me I couldn't take Xanax, and I shouldn't watch a movie or read a book either if I could help it. The point was to not distract myself, to sit still with my fear, to accept it as a part of my life that could not itself hurt me. I still closed my eyes and gripped my armrests when it got bumpy, but I was also exhausted by the therapy, by my fear, by the amount of time I'd let pass without forcing myself to do something brave. By the time I got on that plane, I decided that if I was really going to do this big, scary thing I'd been afraid of for more than 4 years, I might as well commit to confronting another one, too. I would leave home and my best friend with it. When my new friends teasingly asked me when I was moving to New York, I picked a date just 4 months out. September, I said. I was surprised to find I meant it. The part of me that hoped I would die in a plane crash after all, just so I wouldn't have to go through with it, was, I assure you, very small. Chapter 4. I Want to Believe. When I moved to New York in the fall, I left behind my bed, my desk, my dresser. I stashed boxes of my belongings in Riley's storage unit and in my parents' basement. I did not think of this as a very big favor because they would be there only a year. I was thinking of my move as less of a move and more a year-long work abroad. That was the plan, initially, stay a year, then go home. I fit what I thought I'd need into 8 medium-sized boxes and shipped them to my new apartment on the Lower East Side of New York, and then I got on a plane and went. It was the easiest flight I'd had in years because I was too excited to think about dying. I was going to move into a new apartment with a new roommate, Kiara, a fellow hairpin rider I'd become a big fan of who already lived in New York. We'd met only once in person, on my last trip to the city, but we talked online almost every day. I'd found her email address several months back and written her a gushy note about her work. She replied immediately, equally generous in her use of exclamation points. Within a few days, we were great friends. When I posted a picture of my New York apartment on Instagram to announce my move and to brag, people gushed and cooed. I had not yet seen the apartment in person myself. I edited and filtered a photo Kiara had sent me. Over the month we'd been looking, she'd seen 3 or 4 places and fallen for this one. I'd seen the listing online and the pictures she sent me, and I had her word that it was really very nice. "It's pretty small, though," she kept saying. And I kept saying, "Sure," like I understood. All I could see were the wood floors, the bright windows, the skylight. The exposed brick walls I knew were coveted because I'd heard people say exposed brick walls on TV shows about New York. The rent, while more than twice what I'd been paying in Minneapolis, was, I was told, very good for the area. So it's small, I thought. It was only for a year. Then I got there on a very hot day at the very end of August, and when I saw my room, I laughed. I lay down on the floor with my feet pressed against the door and reached my arms above me, touching the opposite wall. This was the longer side. I could not lie fully extended the other way. For the first few days, I slept on the futon Kiara brought from her previous place, a gray-brown thing that was more like 2 slabs of fabric-covered metal rods stuck together than a piece of furniture in its own right. But I didn't mind. In the mornings, I had an office to go to, which was very welcome after almost a year spent working in sweatpants for my bed. In my first week, I took the wrong subways in the wrong directions at least 4 times and cried because of it twice. That first week, before I'd bought a bed, we had a housewarming / welcome to New York party, and 60 or 70 people crammed into our 400-square-foot, air-conditioner-less apartment. The man I was interested in, the one I'd liked since my last stint in New York, when I decided to move there, eventually showed up, alone, with a bottle of wine, after I worried he wouldn't come at all, and so did many of my new friends. I got so giddily drunk I sprayed a bottle of red wine on the wall in the process of opening it, leaving stains that were still there when I moved out. When it got too hot and too crowded, we went up to the roof to spread out and cool down, and even though I'd had a hard first week, I felt that I was where I was supposed to be. That feeling lasted unchallenged for all of 5 or 6 months. As long as it took for me to meet all my internet friends for drinks once, to get over the novelty of taking the subway to work, to realize exactly how much money I was spending, to see all the major museums I wanted to see, to start dating and promptly get dumped by the man I had thought, I'm embarrassed to say, would be the new boyfriend to go with my new life. It's just as well he wasn't, since my new life turned out to be incredibly cramped. My 6th-floor walk-up apartment on the Lower East Side in New York was so small I had to take my closet door off the hinges so that my IKEA double bed could fit in my room. In the summer, I lay in bed sweating, and in the winter, I froze, woken every night by a radiator that clanked and hissed almost pornographically, but did not produce any real heat. Outside my apartment, I felt overstimulated and antsy, but inside it, I felt trapped. Despite the fact that I'd moved to New York determined to stay a Minnesotan, I refused to get a New York driver's license and swore I'd vote absentee. I'd still moved to this new city to change my life. To experience discomfort so that I might become something I couldn't otherwise have been. I'd achieved the first part, but I still felt the same. I also felt guilty about having abandoned Riley. That's what it felt like I'd done, at least. Never before in our friendship had she been the one left behind. Our dynamic until then had been closer to that between sisters. My needy, less experienced one to her wiser, free spirit. I think we both always assumed that if our friendship grew strained, she would be the one doing the tugging. I know I loved her more in the early years of our friendship than she loved me. But I also know that no friend has ever loved me as much as she did, even then. And for that, I felt I owed her my life. I assumed I'd always want to be there for her, physically present, the first on the scene. This was what I thought it meant to be someone's best friend when I was young. Unwavering, selfless, permanent. My sense of duty is so ingrained that if it weren't for all the fear and physical weakness, I'd have made a perfect Marine. But after 8 years of friendship, the dynamic between Riley and me had shifted. She helped me become a person who could move away from her. Still, being away from her wasn't easy, especially once it was clear that some of the people I'd thought would become good friends of mine in New York wouldn't. In fact, some of the people who had seemed close to me, watching from the internet back in Minnesota, weren't even good friends with one another. People had their own lives. I hadn't had much of one before I moved, but a few months in, after my brand newness had mostly worn off, it was hard to remember why I'd been so sure that moving across the country would make it easier to get one. It was around this time that I started reading my horoscope every day, off an app I downloaded because cool women on the internet were tweeting about it. And then I downloaded another one, too, using one set of predictions to moderate the other. It was the first thing I did when I woke up in a room I hated. And for a while, reading my horoscope gave me hope that my life could still change for the better without any more effort on my part. I'd drained my savings to move across the country and live in a box. Wasn't that enough? The spring after I moved to New York, a pair of astrologers told me I was going to marry an older man from another country. As it happened, a few nights earlier, I'd attended a singles mixer for people obsessed with death, ostensibly for work, and had given my card to a handsome 38-year-old man from Argentina. We'd met during the icebreaker portion of the evening. An uncomfortable endeavor in any setting, but, I assure you, never more so than at a singles mixer at a morbidity museum. Pretty much everyone there was a goth, a funeral director, a tattooed Wiccan, a taxidermist, or all of the above. It didn't take me long to identify the only other person there with a sense of humor about the unusual circumstances in which we found ourselves. He was seated across the table from me, and he was cute. As instructed, we asked each other to explain the icebreaker words written on the labels stuck to our chests. I'd written spectrophilia, a sexual fetish for ghosts, on mine, and, having been asked to explain it 3 times by then, regretted it immensely. His name tag read, Baby Bird, and when I asked why, he told me that he'd saved one that morning. He'd named it Kowalski, because, he said, every wounded soldier you root for in a war movie is named Kowalski. I found this very funny, only partly because I was drunk. This guy was friends with one of the women running the event, and this, in my eyes, made him normal. Sure, we were both there, but only ironically. When one of the hosts climbed up onto a table and ordered everyone to participate in trivia, we stood side by side, rolling our eyes at the dork in the top hat who shouted his every answer. We refilled our plastic wine cups together and made small talk about what we each did for work. When I told him I was a writer, hence my attendance at this event, he said he'd be sure to look out for my story. I'd spent 27 years on Earth without ever having given anyone my business card for flirting purposes. This seemed as good an opening as I'd ever get. I pulled one from my wallet and handed it to him, trying to make it clear that I wanted him to contact me if he was interested, while still acting vague enough for plausible deniability if he wasn't. He took my card, smiled, and put it in the pocket of his shirt. Soon after that, I waved goodbye and left. 3 days later, I met the astrologers. A coworker and I had arranged for them to visit our office and read our star charts for an article. I loved them both immediately. They were warm, smiley, and just enough older than me that I was ready to believe just about anything they might tell me. They read my coworker's chart first. She was visibly impressed, which, despite my determination to stay objective, made me giddy with excitement for my own reading. When it was my turn, they told me some things I already knew about myself. That I'm a Sagittarius, Leo rising, that I'm a hard worker who likes structure, that I like socializing but prefer small groups, and some that I didn't know but would certainly love to believe. That I was destined for great career success, that I was very independent, largely because I'd endured several long and dramatic romances in my past life, that I was a born leader. Then, finally, we got to the part I most cared about, the thing I always skimmed around for whenever I read my horoscope online, love. The astrologers told me that I was somewhat of a late bloomer, and I laughed in a way that indicated that that was a pretty big understatement. They asked for a few details about my relationship history, which did not take long to summarize. Then they told me that my chart showed me becoming involved in a whirlwind romance with an older man, probably 10, 15 years older and likely from a foreign country. Oh my God, I said. My coworker, who knew about the man from the singles mixer, gasped. Does that ring true? One of the astrologers asked. Well, I gave my number to a 38-year-old from Argentina a few nights ago, I said. He hadn't texted or called, but surely there was no way that he could meet such specific criteria and not be the person the astrologers were talking about.